This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
What we've seen in Kent, this is what I fear we will see nationally, is a political movement with no deep roots, united not by a philosophy or a set of values, but brought together by what they don't like. And what we're seeing already in Kent is that uneasy coalition falling apart.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast.
In this week's episode, we hear how Chancellor Rachel Reeves had a dig at Kent County Council, Whitstable locals were suspicious of Southern Water's sewage efforts, and a £50 million biofuels plant was announced for the county. I'm Simon Finley, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Robert Boddy, who reports on Medway.
Hello.
And Dan Essen, who takes care of the borough and district councils.
Hello.
And Nikki White, who looks after what's been happening with the county's MPs.
Hello.
And our special guest today is County Councillor Andrew Kennedy, who represents the Tories in Malling North East. First up, Dan, what have you been looking at?
So in a slight change of pace, I've actually been looking at the activities of Southern Water, the, as you know, much-loved private water company which manages sewage and so on across a large part of the North Kent coast.
What have they been up to this time?
So they run an online monitoring tool which the public can use to keep an eye on sewage releases into the sea, because so frequent are they. It allows swimmers to make informed choices about whether they'll go swimming, kayaking, all that sort of thing. But the weekend before last came to my attention that they reported there was a 100-hour sewage discharge over the course of an entire weekend. Yeah, that's pretty severe, but wouldn't be immensely surprising given the state of our water firms. The twist, however, is that the report actually wasn't true.
Oh, right. So that's actually a good thing, isn't it?
Well, yeah. No, obviously, no, 100-hour sewage discharge would be very bad. The real one was much shorter. But campaigners from the local organisation SOS Whitstable told me this. They flagged it, and they told me that this basically shows Southern Water marking their own homework through this monitoring thing, and they're not even much good at it, was their argument. They picked up that the report must have been an error, flagged it with Southern Water, who quickly corrected their records and the public monitoring website. Yeah, and obviously, thankfully, it was well under 100 hours. Southern Water tell me they're continuing to monitor things and ensure this tech problem doesn't occur again, but that's unlikely to endear them any further to the people of Whitstable, I reckon.
Robert, what about you? What's happening there, boy?
This week, planning permission was approved to extend a biofuel production plant in Kingsnorth on the Hoo Peninsula, which will convert old cooking oil into a diesel replacement biofuel. Syntec Biofuel is investing £50 million into the site, which will produce the most sustainable fuel in the UK, and have a specific research and development centre creating 20 jobs. It's part of a wider investment programme which will ultimately bring 200 jobs to the area.
What will this fuel be used for then?
So the site currently produces 1 million litres per month, with this figure estimated to double by early next year following this expansion, and the fuel is generally produced for the construction industry, and so this new facility is to provide fuel for those involved in the construction of the Lower Thames Crossing. Tom Bingham, CEO of Syntec Biofuel, said its use would make the Lower Thames Crossing the greenest road ever built.
Hi, Nikki. What's been going on at Westminster?
It's some good news, which is refreshing. After months and months of lobbying, Virgin has confirmed its international trains will stop at Ashford and Ebbsfleet once the services are up and running. So Richard Branson's rail business plans to begin cross-channel services by 2030, so a bit of a way off, but that's happened after its application to share Eurostar's Temple Mills train depot in East London with Eurostar was approved. Now, the firm has said that it will only stop in Kent if the stations are updated, and that's obviously going to cost money.
It's still good news for the isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, Eurostar stopped calling at Ebbsfleet and Ashford in March 2020, just as the pandemic was getting underway. And many people have been calling for the return of international services ever since, including several Kent MPs. And they've been working hard to try and make this happen. Now, the move, which was announced at the end of last week by the rail regulator, the Office of Rail and Road, that will bring to an end almost three decades of Eurostar's monopoly on Channel Tunnel passenger services. Now, what the regulator has done is to approve Virgin's application to share Eurostar's East London depot at Temple Mills. Now, you might wonder why that's so important, but the depot is the only one that can be accessed from High Speed 1, and that's the line that runs between London and the tunnel, where those particular trains can be maintained and stored. So we're still some way off services getting up and running, but this is a really, really crucial first step. Now, Ashford and Ebbsfleet have continued to operate domestic high-speed services for the past 5 years, but for anyone like me who enjoyed a trip over the channel from Ebbsfleet or Ashford, and particularly enjoyed how easy that whole process was, hours. It's been a bit galling that you have to travel all the way into London before coming all the way back on yourself to use Eurostar. And at some point, you'll probably be stood on the platform at Ashford or Ebbsfleet to go into London, and you'll see the Eurostar whizzing past just to rub salt into that wound.
So is Virgin going to change all that?
That's the plan. It's understood Virgin Services will call at both stations from day one, but a question mark now hangs over who will pay to upgrade the sites. Now, they've stood empty for some time, and also the new European Union entry-exit system has been introduced since then, so it means both stations are going to need to be updated with the latest border technology. Understandably, campaigners are calling on the government to step in and bring some of that money. The Rail Minister, Lord Peter Hendy, he has said that the government will continue to champion the reopening of Ashford and Ebbsfleet international stations, although he didn't actually say they would fork out the money. So that's something that's obviously going to need to be addressed. So, however, for the time being, Ashford MP Sojan Joseph, who's been a huge champion for this, he said the ORR's decision was a fantastic step in ending Eurostar's monopoly on European travel, and that the statement from Lord Hendy was really encouraging.
OK, thanks, Nicky.
So, Simon, another quiet week at County Hall?
Well, I guess you know when you've got under the skin of the government is when the Chancellor of Exchequer has a pop at Reform UK running Kent County Council. For some reason, Rachel Reeves added in a line to her pre-budget speech on Tuesday morning, claiming that KCC under Reform had not managed to find the big savings it had promised and was going to put up council tax as well for millions. This was interesting largely because the Chancellor's speech said virtually nothing other than to give a veiled warning that everyone's going to feel the pain, and that probably means tax rises. But we'll come back to that later on. But the line absolutely infuriated KCC leader Lyndon Kemp-Caron, who described Rachel Reeves' characterisation as an outright lie, and that she was deflecting the attention away from Labour's own troubles. She said in an interview, "I was shocked, to be honest. This was the Chancellor of the Exchequer. She's got a budget to deliver in just a few weeks, and instead of focusing on the job in hand, she's trying to deflect from her own shortcomings by what is going on at KCC. I mean, I've never heard anything like it." Strong stuff from Lyndon, and I didn't realise she was that sensitive. But of course, Lyndon Kemp-Caron will argue that she and her team at County Hall have indeed identified many millions of savings through scrapping the sale of Sessions House, doing away with net zero, and tightening up on home to school transport. The opposition have and will continue to argue that this is all nonsense, or that the savings are indeed illusory. But considering this was a speech to the nation, it seems slightly incongruous, even bizarre, to hear Rachel Reeves calling out Reform and KCC in this way. But Lyndon Kemp-Caron will probably be quite happy to have something else to say after having to constantly fight fires inside her own party in recent weeks. It's been a tough past 3 weeks since the leaked video emerged of her swearing and raising her voice to members in what was a private meeting online that ended up being published by The Guardian. Although with the 5 expulsions so far, the heat seems to have died down a bit, but one senses this has probably got a way to travel yet.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Andrew Kennedy has acted as a major tactician for the Conservatives in Kent for many years, as well as serving as a county councillor. There wasn't much that he could have done about the catastrophe that befell the Conservatives in May when they lost control of Kent County Council after nearly 3 decades in charge. Andrew joins us today. Hello. How are you doing?
Hello. Hi, Simon. How are you?
Not so bad, thank you.
Good.
Look, the Conservatives went into the election in May with 57 councillors and emerged with just 5 having been trounced by Reform UK. You've had a few months to reflect on what happened. Can you explain why there was such a heavy defeat?
Well, we didn't get enough votes. Yeah, I mean, that's it. So, to expand on that...
Nearly,
bit,
really?
Yeah, I'll try and expand on that. There were 2 things. First of all, the tidal wave of Reform, which hit stronger in Kent than anywhere else.
Yeah.
That's understandable because, of course, Kent is on the front line with the small boats, which caused a lot of anger.
Yeah.
And a perception of unfairness, and Reform provided very easy answers to those difficult problems. And, of course, there was a feeling of change. You know, we'd had a change of government. People felt the Conservative Party had let them down nationally and locally. And Reform were happily in place to pick up the protest votes of everybody who felt they'd been let down by the national policies. One thing I would like to just comment on, though. Every week in County Hall, we hear news about the Reform's massive mandate, which I like to say. And yeah, I'll admit they won fair and square under the electoral system, and it's a system which I support. But they only got the support of 10% of the people of Kent. 34% of those who voted, 10% of the people. So it is the lowest percentage of the vote ever polled by a party that won the election. And while they won, and they won fairly under those rules, it isn't an overwhelming mandate for the scale of the changes that they are trying to make.
Well, that's an argument that's been played out many, many times. But the fact of the matter is the Conservatives now got 5 members, yep, and they had 57 before. How on earth do you start trying to rebuild at County Hall? I mean, leaving aside local government reorganisation, which is coming down the track, but you still, as a party, as a countywide party, you're somewhat diminished. How do you do it?
Well, the first thing we realise is 20,000 more votes and we would have had 25 councillors. So we fell short very narrowly in an awful lot of places. You know, 50 votes here, 70 votes there. So we need to learn lessons about how to target our resources a little bit more efficiently. We need to be perhaps a little bit more aware of the disinformation that Reform used to motivate their base. Mm-hmm. We perhaps didn't see that coming. And the last thing we need to do is try and out Farage Nigel Farage.
You say that you should try and out Farage.
No, we shouldn't. We mustn't try and do.
Yeah.
You know, there is still a huge number of centre-right people who, you know, do not want a Reform-led council or a Reform-led government. In fact, the overwhelming majority of people don't want that.
The fact that there was a pretty significant unseen congregation which I went out to vote that day that hadn't been identified. And it's much in the same way in somewhere like Northern Ireland, where there's a huge swathe of the Protestant vote don't go out and vote. And that's one of the reasons why Sinn Féin are now in power, because they've managed to motivate their people to go out and vote. Do you think that that was one of the reasons why, you know, Reform crept over the line by those 50 and 75 votes in some places, rather than sort of you taking them by a squeak?
No, I think, I can look at my own division, where I've done a lot of research into why we had the outcome we did, and I was one of the 5 who maintained my seat with a significantly reduced majority. But what happened in Morling North East is about 1/3 of Conservative voters voted Reform. 1/3 of Conservatives stayed at home.
Yeah.
And Reform pulled out maybe 10-15% of people who don't normally vote, or may have voted for Boris, may have voted in the referendum, but don't vote in local elections. So for us, it's, as I said earlier, it's not a case of trying to out Farage, Nigel Farage. It's actually reconnecting with that large group of people who lent their vote to Reform to teach us a lesson, or stayed at home. And that's our pathway back to significant involvement in local government.
So are you pinning your hopes on Reform UK basically sort of like slipping up at some point?
What we've seen in Kent, this is what I fear we will see nationally, is a political movement with no deep roots, united not by a philosophy or a set of values, but brought together by what they don't like. And what we're seeing already in Kent is that uneasy coalition falling apart. Because unlike the big parties, who have roots in the community, roots in a set of political values, Reform are actually just a hodgepodge collection of people who are angry, and they have very few solutions. And we've already seen in Kent, they are failing. They are failing on small boats where they have no influence at all. They're failing on their budget savings. We have already got a Freedom of Information Act where the Kent County Council have said Doge have found no savings and they are not involved in negotiations in Kent. So we've got Lyndon Kemp-Caron saying that council tax is going to go up along with 6 other Reform councils. We've got the splits within Reform, which make Kent look like a flying circus. You know, it's not nice for Kent residents to see their council headline on "Have I got news for you?" People expect better. And the saddest thing about this, Simon, the saddest thing is people are going to be disengaged further from local politics because they thought Reform were going to come in and make a real difference.
Yeah. Well, the question was how you thought they had got on the first 6 months, but I think you answered that, yeah. But when you actually saw that video of Lyndon Kemp-Caron on a virtual Teams call with all her councillors, or most of them anyway, and quite clearly, I know it was a selected clip and put together and edited to make it look probably a lot worse than it actually was, perhaps. But I know that an awful lot of the backbenchers who were on that call were actually really kind of upset and angry at the way she had behaved. Mm. But when you saw it, so how did you react to it? Were you shocked and appalled, or were you punching the air with delight, knowing the damage it was going to do?
I've spent most of my life in politics trying to make politics accessible and relevant to people who we need to participate. My first feeling was, this isn't going to help anybody from any political party connect with people. Because I just thought it was a bit vulgar. It was a bit aggressive and unnecessary. I mean, I've been a councillor under three different council leaders. Roger Gough, who was a thorough gentleman. Nick Heslop, who led Tunbridge and Morning. And Matt Borton, who took over from Nick Heslop in Tunbridge and Morning. I have never heard any of them use that level of profanity, either in a private meeting or a public meeting. Mm. And I thought it was indicative of the pressure Lyndon may be under, that she felt to assert her authority, she had to swear like that as her colleagues. And she's paid a high price for it.
Yeah. I suppose a part of the problem is that when 57 new colleagues come together, and they're all strangers, and you're trying to manage 57 strangers, and then suddenly there's a few egos and a few people whose noses were out of joint because they didn't get a job in the cabinet or whatever, then suddenly you're going to have a few problems. I mean, Roger had exactly the same problem when he had 60, something like that, and then you've only got jobs to hand out to 25 of them, and then suddenly you've got, you know, literally dozens of backbenchers sort of kicking their heels wondering why they didn't get picked, and or plotting and causing trouble because they haven't got anything better to do.
So Roger had 60. I think we lost four over the four-year period. How Roger tried to deal with this was through calm negotiation and private meetings. He never exacerbated it by swearing at them in public. And the other thing we need to remember, this is in their first 6 months. This is in their honeymoon. Mm. You know, if they're fighting over the marital bed in the honeymoon, what the hell are they going to be like on the seven-year itch, you know, when they start really hating each other? I mean, if they're like this now, it's not going to get any better, is it?
Yeah, so. Yeah. And when the whole sort of psychodrama began to play out of, you know, first the suspensions, then the expulsions. I mean, it's not bad for you from a political point of view that suddenly, you know, you were the keepers beforehand, and suddenly the people who've come in are sort of not showing themselves to be terribly organised.
I think for me, the sadness is there will now be another cohort of people who feel politicians have let them down. Mm. And before the election, if you read the manifestos that they put out, and the manifestos differed from one part of Kent to another, it was clear they were not going to be able to deliver what they promised to deliver. We said this, we told people, but people weren't listening to us. I think if there was another election for Kent County Council now, there'd be a lot more than five Conservatives and a lot fewer than 50, well, there's already fewer than 57. I think they're down to 47 now, aren't they?
48, I think.
48, yeah. I did actually joke to my colleagues the other day, if it keeps going like this, by June next year, they will be the official opposition.
Do you think that Lyndon Kemp-Caron has weathered the storm, or will she have to go at some point?
I think her chutzpah and her brazen outlook on all of this has bought her some time.
Yeah.
But she hasn't got a united group. Several have now formed another group. There are some more who I think are trying to get back in. Mm. I think Lyndon's greatest skill is, you know, she's a leader in a very shallow pool, you know, and I don't think there's anybody obvious to take over from her.
I do hear that even with the ones that are left behind, some of them have felt sort of, you know, they're forced to kind of get behind the leader because they didn't want to rock the boat. But if my information is correct, then there is still a bit of unhappiness there.
Of course.
But that would be true of a group of that size in any party.
Yeah, but it's fallen apart very quickly.
Mm.
And you and I both know, Simon, there's three or four more who are on the edge and may still be there because of other complications, you know, in terms of how they're going to be removed. There's more stuff coming down the track for them. The budget negotiations, they're going to really struggle when they start having to find those savings. Mm. Yeah, despite all they've claimed, there's still £50 million deficit next year to find, despite all their claims about cutting budgets and making savings. I think the problem for Reform is they have been brought together on this very significant platform of cuts and savings and reductions in council tax. And the reality is very different. Diane Morton, who is a good friend of mine, mm-hmm. you know, we fought many battles together when she was in the Conservative Party, and I think she is one of the most capable cabinet members Reform have. I'm a great fan of Diane. Mm. But she said herself in the Sunday Times, it's already cut to the bone. So where are those savings going to come from?
Well, I did put that to Brian Collins, the guy who's in charge of finance, and basically he sort of said, well, you know, that was a personal opinion. And although she also hinted that there could be the full, you know, council tax increase that's allowed, which is 4.9%, he then said that no decisions had been made. And Lyndon said it again yesterday, that no decisions have been made about council tax.
Well, I'm not sure they are fully aware that if they don't increase council tax by the maximum, then that will affect the amount of grant aid they get from the government. Because the government will say, if you don't have to increase your tax by the maximum, you don't need the full allocation. So 2% below the 4.99 might actually end up 5% when the government penalties are involved, and that will be significant cuts to services.
You've been associated with the Conservatives for a very, very long time. Can you ever remember it being this bad for your party?
I remember a by-election in the 1980s where if that result had been repeated, we'd have no members of parliament. So, yes, I do.
Yeah.
I also remember the SDP in the early 1980s, where projections were giving them 595 seats. They came third at the following election. So I've seen it come and go. The thing in a situation like this is you hold your nerve, you double down on what you believe in, and you dust yourself off and go back out and talk to people.
Tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into politics and why the Conservatives?
So I'm probably fairly untypical. I was brought up in a council flat in Merseyside, a single parent family brought up by my mum. Went to a fairly run-down comprehensive. My mother came from a Protestant Orange Order family, which in Liverpool, if you were a Protestant and you believed in the King, Queen, and the monarchy, you were a Conservative. So despite my poor background, I grew up in a Conservative family. Yeah, my grandparents, who lived in a two-up, two-down house by the docks in Bootle, who put a Tory poster in the window. So that theory of patriotism and conservatism was in my bones as I grew up. The turning point for me, probably, in terms of getting actively involved, was growing up in a council estate. I remember I was probably 10 or 12 years old. And I realised that all the kids around me, the brothers of the kids I was at school with, they all left school, stayed in Merseyside, got a job at the council, lived in a council house, and had a red front door. And I thought, I don't want this. And my mother encouraged me. I didn't go to university. But I got out and got a job when I was, as soon as I could. Within 8 years, I started my first business and I moved south.
So that's your link with the you were a natural conservative.
Maggie was my hero, and we've had nothing like her before or since.
Andrew, local government reorganisation, or LGR as we call it, will change the way councils are run, and in particular Kent may lose all its councils and be replaced by three or four much larger unitary authorities. What's your assessment of the government's LGR?
So I've supported local government reorganisation and unitary councils for the best part of 20 years. So I welcome the legislation. I think anything that saves Kent taxpayers money is welcome. I think where we draw the boundaries is hugely important, because the one thing which is often overlooked is the local council has got to be reflective of those who pay for us. So people have got to feel some sense of involvement with the boundaries for it to be coherent. The one thing, however, that really worries me is Reform UK's policy of pursuing a single unitary authority.
With three assemblies underneath.
Well, this is the interesting thing. So if we had a single Kent unitary authority, it would be the biggest single piece of local government in Europe. Absurd, you know, 1.8 million people, bigger than nine American states. And I questioned officers on this last week about the logistics of these three assemblies. And they said, well, they'd be written into the constitution. Well, the reality is, they can't be. This council can't write the constitution of the council that replaces us. And the council that replaces it might say we don't want anything to do with this. So we may end up with a single Kent-wide authority, the biggest in Europe, you know, nearly twice as big as Birmingham, with no local representation. I said to them, what happens if a different political party controls one of the regional assemblies and they want to do something different? And they said, well, they wouldn't be able to because the leader of Kent County Council would have priority and control over them. So they have no autonomy.
But do you honestly think, Andrew, for one second, that a Labour government is going to take up a Reform UK suggestion of a single authority?
No, I don't.
But having said that, Lyndon Kemp-Caron sort of has always said quite vehemently that she doesn't believe that the multi-unitary model will work either. And more to the point, she doesn't think it certainly won't save any money. If anything, it's going to cost money. And that is backed up by the County Council's network.
Yes.
Which basically says that if you have the model that the government are considering adopting for the Tier 2 authorities, essentially, it's going to cost loads more money than anybody ever thought it would.
So I think the break-even figures are between 3 and 7 years before they start returning the financial savings. But what would make a difference is if we went down the model of Essex and Surrey, where we had a Metro Mayor and a combined authority. Mm-hmm. Because with a Metro Mayor comes an awful lot more funding, an awful lot more control over local services. By going down Lyndon Kemp-Caron's route of a single authority, we are closing the door on an elected mayor and all of the money that comes with us. Because a part of that is a combined authority which holds the mayor to account. And if we have one council, we can't have a combined authority.
Do you think Kemi Badenoch can survive?
I think her conference speech, I was there for it, I think it bought her time. I've known Kemi for many years before she was an MP. Mm. She's tenacious, and I think she is the first Conservative, with a small C, Conservative leader the Conservative Party has had for a long time. Mm-hmm. Whether or not the mountain she has to climb is too big and the decision she'll have to make will make her too unpopular, then perhaps, I don't know. I backed her in the leadership election, and I hope she does make it.
Some people say that Katie Lamb, the Wilder Kent MP, is a possible successor. Would you buy that?
The old answer is there's no vacancy, but I know Katie as well. She's very competent and very capable.
Yeah. Okay.
As are several others. Mm. You know, Robert Jenrick is waiting in the wings. Penny Mordaunt, I'm sure, would like to come back, given a possibility to do so. Mm. So, yeah, there are options if Kemi decides to call it a day.
Yeah. Andrew, listen, it's been fascinating. Thank you very much indeed for your time today.
Thanks, Simon.
This week, the Chancellor dropped some heavy hints that tax rises may be on the way. But will people in Kent accept they have to pay a little bit more out of their wage packets in order to make the economy better and for services to improve? Dan, would you mind paying a penny or two more in tax?
I'd rather not, but it depends what you get in exchange for it. I think that's basically the median position. A lot of people don't really have a problem paying a higher rate of tax as many European countries, which have significantly higher both top and basic rates of tax than us, for example. I think in Denmark, the top rate of tax is about 55%. But in those countries, particularly in Northern Europe, what you get in exchange for that is a significantly more redistributive economy and a public realm which tends to work better for more people. You get much more free childcare, much more time off work, generally more effective law enforcement, a public realm and high streets which don't look like they're falling to pieces. The question is what you get in exchange for it. People in general, they always say taxes are the price of living in a civilised society. And if people feel like they're living in a society which is generally doing well, most people don't mind paying their bit for it. The problem is that most people, quite understandably after years of long experience, don't trust the British government to use their tax money in the most efficient and effective way, which evidently they don't. So I think many people say, well, tell me what I'm going to get for my extra £1 on the penny in income tax, and maybe I'll think about it.
Yeah, I think that people also feel as if they're already paying through, and those are things that work properly anyway. Mm. Things would have to get better pretty damn quick for them not to feel very resentful about having to pay extra.
Yeah, definitely. And like the by virtue of the nature of the taxation system, it's very difficult to make the impact of tax rises or whatever on the public finances and the public realm feel immediate enough for people to care about them to feel like they're getting something out of it. And also it just causes all manner of political problems, and it it helps reinforce tax scepticism. That when, if the government says, yeah, we'll put another 1p on income tax, everyone will say, well, I don't want that. What am I going to get for it? And it makes it harder for them to do it in future, which is why many people would say that the government should have just front-loaded this. And if they're going to increase taxes, should have done it.
But they wouldn't have won the last election, would they, if they'd been saying we're going to have to whack up your taxes?
No, no, of course not. But
or would they, would they have converted 160 into maybe a 70 majority?
Yeah, they knew they were going to have to, though. So a lot of people say if they wanted to minimise the sort of political pain of this, they should have just done it in their first budget after being elected.
Yeah, yeah. Nikki, happy to pay a bit more?
Yeah, a little bit more. I mean, if you're going to get something in return, I think you'll find that most people would be happy to pay a little bit more. I mean, as far as this speech is concerned, though, I'm just not sure it's really helped. Nobody is really any wiser of what's coming up. And with the cynics among us, all it's done is made us think there's something really awful about to be announced, and that this is just a way of softening the blow. It's a bit like picking the edge of a plaster before you rip it off. Kemi Badenoch said the speech was just one long waffle bomb, which a phrase I want to use more often. And there will be plenty agreeing with her. I mean, Reeve said the budget would be one with fairness at its heart, aiming to bring down NHS waiting lists, the national debt, the cost of living. And who doesn't want that? We all want that. And I think most of us will be happy to pay that little bit more. If the predictions are right, and it is only going to be a little bit more, then it all sounds wonderful. But the other thing is, I mean, how many of us actually sit back and work out how much is that going to cost us per year? I don't think many of us do. But, you know, I think the difficulty is that people won't mind paying more, but what they'll want to see is fast results, because they're going to be asked to bear even more cost. They're going to want to see more bang for their buck. And with the state of things as they are, with more and more houses being built, which people are upset about, and GP waiting lists then becoming even longer, it's going to have to be something big. They need some big, obvious changes to represent that extra money that people are being asked to change.
You know, isn't it also that we're kind of ignoring one of the big problems, is that so many people don't actually work, or are choosing not to work, or feel as if they can't work. So those revenues that you know, could be coming in from people, those extra people working rather than the 20% of people who don't, that's possibly a way to achieve that.
Yeah, I mean, it could be, but you've got to deal with what is in front of you at that moment. That's perhaps another bigger question for another day, or maybe for Robert to fill in on. I don't know. I mean, I just think that if we're being asked to pay more, we need to see some fast and big results better. And aren't people used to, you know, politicians turning around and changing their minds in their manifestos? I don't know. But yeah, what do you think, Robert?
I think, well, I mean, a number of years ago, I read this study, which was basically about the expectations of different countries versus how much they're willing to pay for certain services. And it found that the British people expect the most from their social services, but are willing to pay the least of, I think it was, across Europe. And I think, you know, I think many people, if you ask them on the street, will say, yeah, I don't mind paying. You know, if it meant that the NHS works fine and there's police, you know, solving crimes and all that, I'll pay a penny, you know, that's no problem. But then if you put that in a manifesto, a lot of them won't vote for it. I think the purpose of her speech was to try and basically excuse or give a reasoning why they were going to do this. And I think it almost would have been better if she just hadn't, and she just said on budget day, this is what we're going to do. I think where she might succeed slightly is if she increases tax, that brings in more revenue, and that can be put into public services. So at the end of the parliament, things seem to have improved. She will say, you remember it was really painful when I asked you to pay that, but this is what we've got at the end of it. Again, there's a big if of, are services going to be better at the end? Will people forgive her for breaking a manifesto promise? Yeah. I don't know.
Okay, that's your lot this week. Thanks to Nikki, Dan and Robert for their contributions, and to our special guest this week, Andrew Kennedy. Don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics coverage, and you can also sign up to our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5pm. I'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5pm or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.